The following program represents the views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. KCBX welcomes the comments of those with divergent views. Our phone number today is 805-549-8855. It's now 2 o'clock. Time for a conversation with the reluctant therapist. Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and she uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy, healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth. Where are we going today? What's on your mind today?
Hey, Sarah, it's nice to see you. And I'm not sure where we're going, but I kind of have a sense of where I am. So that's the best I can offer you at this point. After this wonderful weekend with Live Oak and all of the participation and all the happy music that we were hearing, I just keep thinking about the messiness of life and how even amidst great beauty, there can be really dark experiences. Or if you flip it the other way, in the midst of rubble, we find great beauty moving through the cracks. And that nothing really happens independently, that we have our joyful moments, even in the midst of great grief. And that when we really think we have our life organized, something seems to always kind of come in and pull us off balance. You know, that pain and joy and turmoil and sadness and happiness all kind of seem to happen at the same times. You know, we had Live Oak. We've had one of my closest friend's daughter got married on Saturday in a virtual wedding ceremony. And then we have ongoing protests. We have ongoing conversations and concerns about the pandemic and masks and health and spikes. And then we have graduation still. All of the things that happen in life happen at the same time. And even good things provide some level of stress on our psyche. Even things that are joyful and wonderful provide some sort of pull in our life, and that we really can't control how everything keeps coming at us, even though we'd like to kind of stop the train and get off. And even when we are at the end of our rope, things can still get worse, and we still are pressed in having to learn how to adapt or succumb or to navigate and move forward. And so I guess that's really been on my mind, because I feel conflicted between, you know, wanting to enjoy some of the beautiful things as they happen, but then wondering and feeling guilty, should I be enjoying these things that are wonderful and beautiful that are happening, because there are a lot of horrible, frightening, overwhelming, sad things that are happening at the same time. And I feel a responsibility to be completely engaged in the struggle and in being a support and being an advocate. But at the same time, I feel this pull towards the joy of my granddaughter being here. And so I know I'm not alone in those thoughts. And I also know I'm not alone in the feeling of being burnt out, because all of our collective fight or flight mechanisms have been pushed to their limit. And I get more and more phone calls or texts or emails from friends and acquaintances and family who are feeling like they don't have much more they can give, whether it's, you know, home with their children and still trying to work full time, or dealing with someone who is sick in the family and trying to care for them and still care for themselves, and feeling the pull in their community to be out and protest and speak out and be part of the actions that are going forward. And I know I'm not the only person who's feeling this sense of guilt and joy and conflict all happening at the same time. And as things happen in life, just when you feel like you don't have anywhere to go, something pops up. And I happened to attend a short webinar this weekend about kind of rebirths and moving forward. And during this webinar, the person who was presenting it talked about this little known goddess, a Hindu goddess that I have actually done a show about 3 years ago, and I'd completely forgot about this goddess and forgot about the show. But the goddess is Aki Landa Sharwi, which means the never not broken goddess. And this little known goddess is known for resilience and the ability to completely come apart and then come back together. And each time this goddess comes back together, she is stronger and more resilient and more capable of moving forward. And I've been thinking about that idea of the process that all of our lives seem to be in for most of our life, which is in a process of coming together or falling apart, or falling apart and falling apart and falling apart and finally coming together. But that is the journey that most of us are on, that we are maybe at the same time coming together and falling apart all at once. And what we really are searching for are the skills to move through, to deal with, manage, be able to persevere through the coming apart process. And another thing that came up this weekend was the idea of kintsugi, which is a Japanese tradition of taking broken pottery or pottery that's been damaged and then reforming it with gold, with really beautiful elements. And then the piece that is made after the pottery has been cracked is actually more beautiful than the original piece. And so I keep thinking again, how can we utilize this moment of time where we all feel like we're coming apart and coming apart, and see it as an opportunity for growth and for the possibility of new beginnings. And even when things are so messy and awful and we can't see the light and we're not really sure where we're going, to somehow have faith or trust in the process that we at some point are going to come back together, that we will be stronger and find our way. And it's on every level. It's not just as a community or as a society or as a culture, but individually. On an individual level right now, so many of us are in this experience of coming apart, dealing with economic struggles and the pandemic, and within our own homes, you know, what is the right balance? Should we be socially distancing? Should we be wearing masks? Should we be going out and protesting? Should we, you know, be coming together as a couple and talking about our marital issues right now, or should we put that on hold? Because nothing pauses in life. We want it to pause, but nothing really pauses. And one of the challenges of this coming apart is that it can become so overwhelming if we're constantly in the state of feeling like we're struggling or in this fight or flight mode, that at some point we lose our energy for the fight and start to turn inward or start to shut down. And when we start to turn inward, we start to shut down, there is this natural response of feeling depressed and having this depressive position. Our emotions are depressed. And I'm not talking about depression in the biological sense, but I'm talking, or even in a clinical psychology sense, but the sense of heaviness or weightedness or feeling like I can't keep slogging through. And today I want to explore this position that I think many people are experiencing, because currently, there's been a 30% increase in calls for mental health services amongst a population of people who have never before identified themselves as experiencing mental health issues like depression. And I think what's happening is this collective experience of melancholy or of this depressive position where we have been so stretched in trying to cope and adapt and move forward and adjust, that we just have hit this burnt out point. In the profession, we call it stress overload, that our psyche and our bodies have a capacity to deal with stress and overwhelm and tragedy and trauma. We have the capacity, but all of us also have our limit. And when we have too many stressors hitting us from too many different directions, we get to a point that we call stress overload. And it can be represented by this feeling of melancholy, of sadness, of deep depression, of a heaviness, of this feeling like you are just slogging along. And I want to kind of explore today how that melancholy can actually be here as a way of serving our process of coming together, or helping to make the coming apart more gentle. And that if we can reframe and look at this idea of melancholy or stress overload, if we can look at it and normalize it as a natural response to unnaturally high levels of stress and coming apart everywhere, unraveling in our personal lives and our psyches and our community and our culture, if we can step back and say, it's not just me, it's not just an illness that I am experiencing, it's actually a natural, healthy response to the things that are happening around me, then how can we utilize these feelings of melancholy or the depressive position or stress to actually help us to move towards a coming together? And I'm not really sure where that takes us. I have some ideas, but I don't have an answer. I have some information, but I don't have the fix. And so I'm just going to open it up. And I've invited one of my friends, Kyle Berlin, to join us today because Kyle has had an experience researching melancholy in different countries. He also has experienced melancholy in his life. And I thought it'd be nice to have his experience to join us today. But I'm also going to be opening up to you if you'd like to share your thoughts or have a question and be part of the conversation. Although we can't do it as our traditional phone calls, you can call at 805-549-8855 and ask a question or leave a comment. If you're feeling bold, you can also zoom into the conversation and talk to me directly. And Sarah and has that number if you'd like to zoom into the conversation. But I am Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can also reach me on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. You can always send me an email to Elizabeth@TheReluctantTherapist.com and listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show to share with others or to listen at your convenience by podcasting A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist and hitting subscribe. I look forward to seeing where the show takes us today. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to get started with Kyle and your calls. I'm blue. What I won't be blue always. 'Cause the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday. Trouble in mind, that's true. I've almost lost my mind. Life ain't worthwhile living. Feel like I could die. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And as I said before, I don't have a direction, but I have some ideas, and I have some tips also to talk about how we can utilize our own resources, our own internal resources to develop more resilience and to kind of deal with and cope with stress overload during this during these times of a lot of pressures from a lot of different directions. And all of us have our capacity of how much we can take, and then we start to shut down or feel that sense of depression. And I just wanted to make sure I'm not diminishing chronic depressive disorder or the diagnosis of chronic depression or deep depression, but I wanted to address this 30% increase in feelings of depression that have been reported since March in people that in the past had no experience or history of identifying with depression. And I think that's an important and significant number, because when we have so many people experiencing for the first time this sense of melancholy or this depressive position, it's a sign that a lot of people have hit their stress overload, that they're not quite sure how to move forward, that they're starting to feel hopeless or feel frustrated or feel like they're in an untenable position. And so I wanted to, again, try to normalize this as a normal reaction that's uncomfortable and overwhelming, but not a sickness, but actually a symptom of what's happening socially, globally, in our community and in our homes. And I've invited Kyle Berlin to join us today. And again, Kyle is not an expert on mental health, but he has his own experience with mental health and melancholy and also with researching it. So I invited him here today. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, Elizabeth. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. So can you talk a bit about your research into melancholy and where it took you after graduation?
Yes. So this started, I guess, in the middle of my college career. I went to college on the East Coast, and I had an opportunity to apply for a grant to undertake an independent research project. And for some reason or another, what occurred to me most was to pursue a research project into melancholy, because this is something that I was both personal to me, something that I experienced throughout my life. I experienced sadness in everyday ways, and most of the time it's not a deep depressive state or anything like that. It's just a sort of awareness of the sadness of the world. But I also had an intellectual and sort of literary interest in melancholy as a topic. There's a very long history going way back to the ancient Greeks of this topic of melancholy, of what they call black bile, the whatever it is that's inside us that makes us feel in a bad way. And so I ended up traveling across Europe, studying melancholy, ruin, and memory across that continent, and produced a whole bunch of different results or findings, I guess, somewhat literary findings, not scientific findings, but findings nonetheless.
Well, and I think that the idea of melancholy, and it was actually an American Psychological Association diagnosis up until just the last decade. It had its own, kind of section of the DSM, but it was removed and kind of replaced by many more of the depressive disorders. But the melancholy, which is interesting from the literary stance, it comes in quite often in very creative and heart-centered people. And one of the reasons I went to you is that people who know that you went to Princeton and that you actually graduated as the valedictorian of Princeton. And if you were going to have this, sphere of what people are trying to aspire to or what parents want their children to do, in many ways, you like hit that zenith by taking those academic steps. But at the same time, I've known you since you were quite young, and this depressive disorder or the melancholia has been a real struggle. And the research kind of backs up that some of our most creative people and those who are the most prone to activism and leading movements themselves struggled with this black vial, as you call it. And what other examples did you find?
Yes, I found this to be true across the countries that I visited and the people that I spoke to. I actually called the project In Search of Eleanor Rigby, referencing that Beatles song about all the lonely people. And what I found is what you're saying, that so many of the people who testify to experiencing this melancholy, this sense of sadness, were also extremely deeply creative and highly motivated, or, extremely artistic in a sense. And, I don't know if there's scientific reasons for why this might be, but my own the people I spoke to, my own theories sort of brought me to the idea that it has to do with an abundance of sensitivity and awareness that's paid to the world. So when you're super sensitive to the world, when you're really aware about what's going on around you, I mean, you have to be at least a little bit sad. We live in a sad world and a beautiful world, but sad too.
Right, because it's messy and everything happens at once, which is what great poetry and great literary works are kind of based on. And if you look geographically, because I know that some of the places you visit, like there's geographical locations where there's more melancholy in the population, it's like Ireland, and right?
Absolutely. And that expresses it in the culture of those countries. So I'm going to study in Ireland next year, hopefully. And a big part of the reason that I was drawn to that island is because there's such a rich cultural history of sadness. It comes from being historically oppressed by the British Empire, but it also comes and is expressed in a much more sort of ineffable, in the music, in the landscape itself. It seems to hold this sense of the sorrow of being alive. But then on the other side of that coin, of course, is the joy of being alive. And, you know, I'm sure people have heard this said, and I find it very much to be true, that in order to really savor the joy of life, I find that sorrow, you have to be able to feel the sorrow of it as well. They come together.
And I think one of the reasons I wanted to talk about today is because we live in such a medically modeled, Western way of looking at mental health that really isn't aligned with a lot of cultures around the world, that we have a very specific way of looking at what is well and what is ill. And in our culture, when someone is feeling depressed, we instantly label them as being ill instead of looking at the holistic piece of this. What would be driving this? What would be a natural response to feeling depressed? And that would be grief, you know, deep sadness, experiencing trauma or tragedy. The natural response would be this deeply seated sadness. But also in healing, we have to in some ways go internally, that we have to be able to get quiet enough within ourselves in order to have that physical and emotional healing happen. And in order to get really quiet, we have to depress our state. We depress our emotions. We depress our organs. Everything slows way down. And so we can kind of slog through that process. But of course, the challenge is being in a society that doesn't slow down, that doesn't pause, and that if you're a family, you know, if you're home and you've got children and you're trying to keep food on the table and you're trying to pay attention to the world around you, there is no pause, there is no slowdown. And that's where we kind of run into the danger of the stress overload, or people really feeling at the end of their rope and feeling like their only option is to maybe drink too much or sleep too much or eat too much or find a medication of some sort to numb out, because there doesn't seem to be a pause button. And I thought it would be important to kind of talk about resilience and how we can tap into and build the capacity to kind of raise our cap of stress, like what we can manage moving forward. And I also wanted to bring into the conversation, because you and I had both tapped into this work of Dr. Neil Burton. He's a psychiatrist, a philosopher, a writer from Oxford, England. And he did a TED talk talking about the depressive position as being, you know, different from clinical depression and being part of kind of this important aspect of healing and growth. And I think we pulled, Sarah, if you've got that, we pulled a little bit of Dr. Burton's talk in there to kind of put in perspective what Kyle and I are talking about today. So we're going to hear from Dr. Neil Burton.
Just as physical pain has evolved to signal injury and to prevent further injury, so the depressive position may have evolved to remove us from damaging, distressing, or futile situations. The time and space and solitude that the adoption of a depressive position affords prevents us from making rash decisions, enables us to see the bigger picture, and in the context of being a social animal, to reassess our social relationships, think about those who are meaningful to us, and relate to them more meaningfully and with greater compassion. In other words, the depressive position may have evolved as a signal that something is seriously wrong and needs working through and changing, or at least processing and understanding. Sometimes we can become so immersed in the humdrum of our everyday lives that we no longer have time to think and feel about ourselves, and so lose sight of our bigger picture. The adoption of the depressive position can force us to cast off the Pollyannish optimism and rose-tinted spectacles that shield us from reality, to take a step back, to reevaluate our priorities, and to formulate a realistic, although modest, plan for fulfilling them. Now, although the adoption of the depressive position can fulfill what I would unfortunately call such a mundane purpose, it can also enable us to develop a more refined perspective and deeper understanding of ourselves, of our lives, and of life in general. From an existential standpoint, the adoption of the depressive position obliges us to become aware of our mortality and freedom, and challenges us to exercise the latter within the framework of the former. By meeting this difficult challenge, we are able to break out of the mold that has been imposed upon us, discover who we truly are, and in so doing, begin to give deep meaning to our lives. Many of the most creative and insightful people in our society suffer or suffered from depression or a state that may or would have been diagnosed as depression. They include the politicians Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln, the poets Charles Baudelaire, Elizabeth Bishop, Hart Crane, Emily Dickinson, Sylvia Plath, and Rainer Maria Rilke, the thinkers Michel Foucault, William James, John Stuart Mill, Isaac Newton, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Arthur Schopenhauer, and the writers Charles Dickens, William Faulkner, Graham Greene, Leo Tolstoy, Evelyn Waugh, and Tennessee Williams. And the list just goes on and on and on. To quote Marcel Proust, who himself suffered from very severe depression, "Happiness is good for the body, but it is grief which develops the strength of the mind." I take it the clapping is for Marcel Proust. Now, you see, people in depressive position are often stigmatized as failures or losers. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. If these people are in the depressive position, it is because they have tried too hard or taken on too much, so hard and so much that they have made themselves ill with depression. In other words, if these people are in the depressive position, it is because their world was simply not good enough for them. They wanted more, they wanted better, and they wanted different. And not just for themselves, but for all those around them. So if they are failures or losers, this is only because they set the bar far too high. They could have swept everything under the carpet and pretended, as so many people do, that all is for the best in the best of possible worlds. However, unlike most people, they had the strength and the honesty to admit that something was amiss, to admit that something was not quite right. So rather than being failures or losers, they are all the opposite. They are ambitious, they are truthful, and they are courageous. And that is precisely why they became ill. To make them believe that they are suffering from some mental disorder or some chemical imbalance in the brain, and that their recovery depends entirely or even mostly on popping pills, is to do them and to do us an immense disfavor. It is to deny them the opportunity not only to identify and address important life problems, but also to deny them the opportunity to develop a more refined perspective and deeper understanding of themselves and of the world around them, and therefore to deny them the opportunity to develop their highest potential as human beings. Thank you very much.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and that was Dr. Neil Burton. You can listen to his full TED Talk just by searching around Dr. Neil Burton, The Depressive Physician. But I wanted to play that piece today because I think it's so important to start recognizing and tapping into all of the hard work we are doing individually and as a community in all of the aspects of our life. But I think one of the dangers of our mental health care in this society is that when someone starts to struggle, feeling depressed, feeling overwhelmed, we immediately start pointing to illness or disease, which strips the person, the individual, of the ability to actually tap into what the melancholy or the depression is telling them, which is you need to turn in your inward a bit, do some thoughtful reflection, or take a moment to catch your breath, or to recognize the things you're doing well and to build on that. Because what happens is when we start to medicalize every experience we have as human beings, we start to limit the potential we have for growth, for coming together. Because the depressive position piece is all about the coming apart. As we talked about the never not broken goddess, that feeling of coming apart, part of that is feeling depressed and like we can't move forward or that we're overwhelmed. But if we were to flip that a little bit and think about it in terms of, oh, I must be onto something because I'm having a tough time moving forward. So clearly I am tapping into an area where I'm going to grow or do better or going to emerge a different person. And that if we're home with our children, you know, full time and feeling like I can't keep doing the same thing over and over again, instead of doing the same thing over and over again and feeling like a failure, stop for a moment and recalibrate what you are doing over and over. You know, are you showing love to your children? Are you hunkering down as a family and doing the best you can and modeling this resilience? You know, how we look at and approach the things that are happening in our lives impact our mental health and our ability to cope with what is happening in our lives. And so I'm hoping we can switch a little bit how we look at how we're all responding instead of seeing this sense of anxiety or heaviness or the state of feeling pressure to move forward and to act as a negative, as something that's hindering us. If we could see them of all as signs that we're alive, that we're sentient, that we're feeling, that the more deeply you feel something, the more challenged you feel inside, the more you are connected to the world around you. So that's where I'm at today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest is Kyle Berlin, and we're kind of looking at and talking about melancholy as a symptom of the messiness of life, but how it can also be a help for those of us wanting to do more and be engaged in our world. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we're not taking phone calls in the traditional way, but you can call in and ask a question or leave a comment at 805-549-8855. We're going to take a quick break, regroup, and be back to take your calls. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Keep on pushing.
Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. Mm-hmm. I can't stop now. A little higher, some way or somehow, 'cause I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Now maybe someday, I'll reach that higher goal. I know I can make it with just a little bit of soul. 'Cause I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Now look a look, look a look, a look yonder.
great big stone wall stands there ahead of me.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you can leave a question or comment at 805-549-8855. I wish I could talk to you on the air, but we're doing the best we can because we're always regrouping and figuring out how to move forward. And you can send an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com if you want to talk to me off the air. I'm always happy to connect. So when we talk about this depressive position and how do we work with it, there's a difference between kind of succumbing and just allowing the depression to overwhelm us, but to recognize that it's calling for us to take some sort of action. And whether that action is going inward in deep meditative reflective thought, and that can just be as simple as saying to the family, we're going to go for a walk, and putting everyone in a stroller or on a bike, and heading out the door and just moving your legs underneath you for a half hour, or throwing the kids in the car seat in the back seat of the car and going for a drive and just let them listen to music. I mean, how we can grab that time to go inward and have some time for reflection is really key for rebooting our sense of well-being. And that's just one little example of things we can do. But the first thing I wanted to talk about before we talk about resilience, which is something we all have, is to recognize the things that you're already doing that are self-care. Because along with the research that showed that there's been a 30% increase in people identifying as feeling depressed, who never had felt depression before, the other piece of that research also showed that a lot of the depression and feeling of anxiety were that people were pressing so hard to try to stay fit and stay with their diet and do extra classes and do so much self-care that the self-care itself was starting to become stressful. It was starting to make people feel like they weren't good enough or keeping up enough. So the first step to dealing with the depressive position is to start recognizing the ways you already are doing enough. If you're getting up and you're brushing your teeth, that's already a good step in the right direction. If you're taking, you know, a moment to have a conversation with your spouse about something that's unrelated to the crises of the world, but just a reminder of, hey, we're in this together. Or taking a moment to notice every time I get that walk in, even if I'm just escaping my house, it's something I'm doing for myself. Or that glass of water you drink is good for your hydration. In many cases, just being intentional of all the things you're already doing will let you know you're doing enough stuff to self-care. But I want to talk a little bit about resilience because I know that Kyle and I talk about this a lot. That resilience itself is the human capacity to face adversity and turmoil or tragedy or trauma or deal with ongoing significant life stressors and having the ability to bounce back. You know, because all of us will face trauma and tragedy and life stressors, but resilience is the rate of time it takes from experiencing those stressors or the turmoil or tragedy, the time it takes to bounce back to the new normal or to adapt to the new normal or to get back to a level of functioning you're comfortable with. And so we measure resilience on our the rate of ability to bounce back. And some people have natural resiliency skills that they already inhabit, that they're really good at seeing the bright side of things. They already have a strong sense of empathy or compassion. But for a lot of people, if you've never really faced stressful times or really been challenged, you don't have to develop these skills of resilience, and it can be harder to find them. And as a side note, what's interesting is that they found with children, adolescents, young adults who have lived in really severe conditions like war zones or grown up in deep poverty or in areas of domestic violence, they tend to have developed better levels of resilience than other children and young adults who have never really faced stressful experiences. So we see through the research that this capacity to bounce back, this human capacity, is really strong. And that instead of trying to protect our children from facing things that are challenging or difficult or frightening, in some ways, it's best to let them move through these challenging experiences, these traumas, these tragedies, so they can develop these skills of resilience. So I'm going to list them, Kyle, okay? And I want you to pay attention to which ones you relate to. And Sarah, you can as well. But these are the certain personality traits that are associated with people who are resilient. One, they have an internal locus of control, which is a sense of self-moderating. They're able to self-moderate. People with strong resilience have a sense of empathy, a strong sense of curiosity. They have a tendency to seek novel experiences, which means they are looking for new opportunities, learning new information, doing different things. Resilient people have a high level of activity. They like to stay busy, have projects. They are flexible in new situations. They deal well with change. Those with high resilience tend to have a good sense of humor. And of course, that can be judged by what our sense of humor is. But if your friends appreciate your sense of humor, then you have strong resilience. You have the ability to elicit positive regard from others, which is a really interesting skill set to develop if you don't have. How do we develop relationships where people have a positive regard for us, a respect for us, who trust us or feel like they can count on us? But that's a sign of resilience. As someone with personal integrity and a bit of self-protectiveness has strong resilience. And then someone who is able to take pride in their accomplishments and has a capacity for fun also are strong traits of resilience. All right. So Kyle, did you relate to any of those?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's a whole lot of them that I related to. And I guess the one that stuck out to me, or a couple of the ones that stuck out to me, were the sense of humor and the curiosity and the desire for new experiences and new places. And I think both of those kind of get at my own approach to resilience and what I've been able to utilize in my own life, which is that, you know, when you're feeling down, when you're feeling this melancholy, this black bile that we've been speaking about, I think there's a sort of cultural idea that we have to get past it as quick as possible, that we have to just, you know, smush it down or blow it up or some whatever, ignore it, and then move on and keep living with our lives. And instead, I found that with a sense of humor or with a sense of curiosity, you're actually able to take that melancholy and direct it into a new direction. So I think some of the funniest things are things that are born of sadness, or some of the, you know, things that drive me the most in terms of curiosity are me taking this, whatever I'm feeling inside, and applying it towards a new topic or a new area or whatnot. And so that's been very useful in my own life. And I think gets at my own sense of how to deal with this, as well as, you know, culturally in Ireland, speaking of humor, I mean, the culture there, and so many people there are so deeply comedic and so rely on a sense of humor that goes hand in hand with melancholy. And so definitely resonating with what you're talking about.
And I think, you know, if you're struggling with the overwhelm or feeling this sense of sadness or depression, you know, to kind of keep track of those traits and pay attention to which ones you can nurture. And I like the last one, a capacity for fun, because again, as I mentioned at the top of the show, sometimes when we're in the midst of great turmoil, as we're seeing in our culture right now, in every area from political to social to economic, you can feel guilty if you're enjoying anything. And if we stop having a capacity for fun, then that energy we need to be activists or to speak out or to move forward is going to be drained, because the capacity for fun or the ability to laugh at something or to seek a novel experience is inherent in our capacity, in our ability to deal with stress, to deal with things that seem impossible to overcome.
There's this notion that I really like of pleasure activism. It's by this author, Adrienne Marie Brown, and she proposes this notion of, well, activism, or, you know, making the world a better place, always has to be this hard and drudge work. And in fact, she proposes, well, yes, that's true sometimes, but oftentimes it's, you know, finding joy, it's making joy and sharing that joy with others, which is a big part of the activist's work. So I like that a lot as well.
Yeah, and Mary Pfeiffer also talks about her activism. She's a psychologist, and she has done a lot of group groundswell work around trying to prevent the Keystone Pipeline. Mm-hmm. And she said that she'd tried many times to organize groups to get people to take actions. And it wasn't until she found a group and they had potluck gatherings and went Christmas caroling and had fun built into it that they were actually successful in getting things done as a group politically and socially. And so to allow ourselves to find kind of the joy in the actions and joy in the fight. And along, again, I keep kind of going back to the same research project that was done about the increase in depression. And of course, it'll come as no surprise to you. But another piece was the level of loneliness being experienced by those who were sheltered at home alone, the elderly, but also adolescents and young adults who had to go home or left their friend groups, and the importance of finding a way to tap into the resilience of these people who are feeling lonely, helping them to, you know, tap into the finding their sense of humor, or, you know, finding a pride in an accomplishment of some kind. And the suggestions were to keep working with the things that have been really successful are like the drive-by graduations and the drive-by birthday parties and the socially distanced gatherings to help adolescents and young people still stay connected. Because although social media and things like Zoom have been helpful and, you know, given people a place to meet and gather, there's that physicalness of being with a group and feeling a part of something that's really important. And so this is a great time for parents to utilize what's happening socially, politically, to help rally their young people, their adolescents, their young adults, to move together in a group, to coordinate some sort of effort, to find some joy as a family, to do a project, you know, to put together a care package or to make signs or to write a letter together that you can make fun, you know, a fun activity, a family activity in doing something that also connects you to the greater good or to the greater actions. Because adolescents, when they start to feel disconnected, start to get really dark really quickly. And then that concern of depression and the depressive episodes in adolescence can really take hold. And so that's the great age group to start getting them rallied up in activities that are still connected together socially, but not in the same room. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, and I've been feeling it too, you know, the desire for human connection is as real as ever. And also, you know, a lot of the biggest problems that we're facing in this country and in the world, you know, racism has been in the, you know, that's what people have been talking about recently, and rightfully so. I think that, you know, that's a cultural problem. It has roots in policy and whatnot, but it's largely a cultural problem, which means how do we undo it? Well, we undo it with cultural work. And what does cultural work look like? It looks like interpersonal interactions. And so I think everyone has that capacity to do that kind of work and think about it in a different way as well.
And then there again, there's our challenge, because we have this perfect storm of, should we still be at home? Should we be socially distancing? You know, I'm hearing the messiness of life all happening again for the families that are feeling like, but I'm still working full time, but my kids still need to get outside and get fresh air. But I feel like I'm not doing enough to participate politically and socially. I feel guilt that I'm not, you know, keeping my house perfectly clean. And so this, we get caught. That's where the depressive position starts to take over, when we start to judge all of our actions as being negative or not helpful or not participatory. And so how do we flip that and start looking at the things that you're already doing well? Like, what is it one thing a day that you're doing with your family that is positive? Doesn't have to be the whole day. You don't have to have the perfect art project. You don't have to have gone to every single protest. You don't have to have shown up, you know, for every event. And that's, I think, the first step, is that we need to pay attention to how we can live in the messy, that we can accept that things aren't the way they used to be, that we can be okay with feeling crappy. You know, that this depressive position is what it's going to be, because things are falling apart, either for us individually or in our family or in our community. Things are in a place of falling apart. But if we can continue to recognize that it is just the precursor to coming together in a stronger way, and to trust that, and to keep doing the daily things while we almost prepare for the healing, is in some ways the best we can do. Sarah, you were waving a paper to us.
Yes, we've had a couple of call-ins The last caller asks, how do you know that melancholy is sinking into depression? Can you please describe some signs to watch for?
Yes, thank you for that, because I don't want to gloss over it. And it's interesting because melancholy, and I use that word on purpose, because it has the same sense of depression, the feeling of kind of hopelessness, having a hard time getting out of bed, losing interest in activities that used to give you great joy and pleasure. Like, those are symptoms of melancholy. And if they stay, you know, the DSM would say if they linger for more than 6 weeks, then you're looking at, you're moving into a depressive episode that would be more clinical. That would be the clinical way of looking at it. Now, having said that, if we're in a state of a pandemic where we're moving into month 3 and 4 and 5 and things haven't really improved that much, and you're still feeling kind of weighted down and a little listless and hopeless, then I would say that is still situational melancholy. And that if you're able to tap into one or two things a day that give you some sort of pleasure, like if you can still enjoy a glass of wine with your family or laugh at a movie or, you know, find some pieces of pleasure, then that, you know, is more of the melancholy. It is the state that's representative of the situation in which you're living. And it's important, again, to talk about movement and energy. And that's why I'm glad the question is asked about sinking. Because if we do turn inward and just kind of give up the ghost, we don't work with building resilience, then we can sink into a deeper depression that's more difficult to come out of, that can turn clinical, that can really alter our chemistry in such a way that it really becomes long-term. So the important piece to remember about building resiliency skills, moving with melancholy, because again, you aren't probably going to be able to wake up tomorrow and say, I'm going to change my attitude and everything's going to be great. Because the point is, we are in a period of time that's probably going to be a long-term growth period. The melancholy is going to stay. So if you put some energy every day into one thing to help build resilience, and that's either find some way to show compassion, find something that you're curious about, and it can be spending 5 minutes reading something in Wikipedia, just something that's different to piques your curiosity. Find a novel experience, some different way to decorate your house. You know, we have to shake up our psyche a little bit. Find some way to have some fun. Every day, if you put a little bit of time into one of those personality traits that build resilience, then the melancholy will still be there, but it'll be moving through you and it won't become stuck. And the other question, Sarah?
Sure. Anita from San Luis Obispo called in and comments that when people start to feel the stress overload, it helps to remember compassion for other people. It'll give you a second win and help build a better society for all.
Thank you, Anita. And I want to add to that too, compassion for ourselves would be even before compassion for others. Because in some cases, it's easier to have compassion for others to such an extent that we just drain our own well. And so that's why today I wanted to kind of focus on the resilience piece of how do we build our inner capacity to bounce back, to be able to adapt to whatever is happening. And that's in tapping to that sense of self-empathy and self-compassion. And then, as Anita said, you know, find a way to reach out and connect with others. In some form that makes you feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Anita. So, Kyle, in our last couple minutes, as someone, as I said, I know, I've known you forever, and you've kind of overcome a lot of periods of feeling depressed or feeling melancholy. Where is your, you know, you talked about going to Ireland. Where do you see your energy going? Where do you see yourself making a difference moving forward?
Well, that's a good question. And you know, I've been resonating with what you've been saying today, Elizabeth, because all my best laid plans, like everyone else's, got canceled. And so I came from the East Coast, and this tour that I was doing, I came home and have been here, and have sometimes felt like I'm not doing all that I could. You know, I feel I'm at home and my energies and talents aren't being applied in the way that they could. And well, you know, what's the point? And then I think, well, like you were saying, I think, well, what are the things I'm already doing that are meaningful? I go on a walk every afternoon with my grandmother at the beach. You know, that's something that's very small, but very meaningful, both to her and to me. And I think an important part of this cultural work. You know, I maintain correspondence with people who are in prison. Very, very simple thing. Doesn't take a lot of time, but is very meaningful both for them and for me. And so these sort of small acts of interpersonal connection are what I found to be most meaningful in my own life now. And going forward, I want to be able to, I don't quite know what it'll look like yet, but I want to be able to make a career or a life path that's based on valuing those types of connections. So whether that's, you know, as a documentarian or a writer or a social worker, it's, I don't know yet, but something in that capacity.
And I love that you recognize too this simplicity of going for a walk with your grandmother, because I think sometimes we confuse action and actionable deeds as being big gestures, when really, if we all participated in one-on-one charitable experiences, the whole world would improve in some ways, our own mental health and those that we're interacting with. And again, not to sound, sugarcoat things, but at this time, if we were able to just pay attention to one small act with someone in our family in a way that changes their moment, those add up to great big things. And the gift of this time is to maybe give us a chance to build some resilience just in the small things we do every day, so that we, when we are able to move back into the world in a greater capacity, we won't forget how the small things make such a difference in our mental health. Thank you for joining me today, Kyle.
Thank you for having me, Elizabeth. It's been wonderful.
This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can continue this conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show by visiting any place you get your podcasts and search A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. As always, I appreciate you joining us on Tuesdays at 2 and for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.